Hello, and welcome to episode 124 of the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast. My name is Seth Paradin, historian and deputy director of the Mississippi Armed Forces Museum here at Camp Shelby. With me, as always, is retired Navy Captain Bill Todi, former skipper of the fast attack submarine USS Indianapolis, Commodore of Submarine Squadron 3 in Pearl Harbor, and many other postings. How are you this morning, Bill?
Doing great, Seth. My audio is coming by way of Jupiter today, so apparently I've got some kind of audio delay going on, but hopefully that won't affect us too much.
We'll handle up on it. This week, we are always happy to welcome back our good friend, fantastic historian, former United States Marine, Dave Holland. Dave, how are you this fine morning?
Yeah, doing well. And thanks again for having me. And I'm really looking forward to our discussion today, as always.
Absolutely.
Hey, Dave, we got an observer, somebody watched the podcast, comment to me, there's no such thing as a former Marine. And I had to agree with them. How would you like to be referred to, if not former Marine?
No, I'm happy for former Marine.
Okay, that sounds good. Doesn't bother you as much as it bothered that person. But anyway,
some people we'll does.
No,
some
I just, don't want old Sergeant Major to be waking me up at 5 o'clock in the morning to go do PT. Yes. So if I was a Marine, I might potentially do that. So I'm a former Marine. You don't own me.
Play it safe.
Yeah, not anymore, anyway.
Yes.
Well, all right. As the campaign for Guadalcanal winds mercifully down, we're going to shift gears here a bit and focus on some of the other events that happened towards the very end of the campaign on the island. And these are the actions that occurred in the latter months of the campaign, November, December, January, January 1943. Those other forces, of course, that I'm referring to, not just 1st Marine Division or the Raiders or 1st Raiders or anything. We're talking about the United States Army, as well as the 2nd Marine Division and the 2nd Raider Battalion, too. With all the primary focus being on the Marines and Navy offshore, Marines onshore and the Navy offshore, it's easy to forget that the Army also served on Guadalcanal. And it, too, was involved in bitter fighting. And I'm not just talking about the 164th Marines at Henderson either. The Army and the 2nd Marine Division played a vital role in the final offensive on Guadalcanal. And that's what we're going to talk about here today. They were the major force that effectively eliminated what Japanese remained on the island to a point after the 1st Marine Division left the island in December. So with that, we're going to talk about some of these locations like Coley Point, Mount Austin, Galloping Horse, Gifu, Seahorse, and all those good things there. Dave, let's talk about the November action, or I guess offensive, really, around Coley Point, or that occurred around Coley Point utilizing some of these people that we're talking about here. What's going on here after Henderson Field? What are we looking at here?
All right. So in our last discussion, we discussed what occurred after the Battle of Henderson Field. So the Japanese main offensive was stopped. And Vandegrift, the division commander, it gave him the opportunity to go on the offensive because the Japanese, obviously, he was going to take advantage of their setback. So throughout the campaign, they'd been wanting to push the Japanese past the Matanikau. As we've seen, there was three battles of Matanikau earlier. So they want to push them past the Matanikau, past a village called Kukumbana, and all the way to the Poha River, which was a few miles west of Kukumbana. So it gave Vandegrift the opportunity, so he took that advantage. So 1 November, he kicked off a 5-battalion assault across the Matanikau. So the engineers built three bridges. They pushed off. The 5th Marines basically led the charge. So they pushed off, everything went well until they got to a place around the base of Point Cruz. So when they hit Point Cruz, one company, the 1st Battalion, 5th Marines, was struck fairly hard. It was C Company, and they lost a lot of Marines. At the same stage, 2-5, under a famous Marine called Lew Walt, later became a famous Marine. Flanked and helped circle. Then we had our friend Bill Whalen with the Whalen group and some of the 2nd Marine. So what they were supposed to do was hit that point, and then the 2nd Marines were going to push through to Kukumbana. So this is a fairly important action. It's not really spoke about in Guadalcanal history. Every time I go there and I take people there, it's around the Point Cruz area, and I talk about the fighting around Point Cruz. And we'll see later in the episode how the Army And later, some of the 8th Marines of the 2nd Marine Division hit that Point Cruz line. There was some severe fighting in there. And it's one of the parts of the campaign that most people don't even realize. I mean, there was one U.S. tour group there when I was there one time. And that was where all the main hotels were. And I think we discussed it in an earlier episode with the Monroe and the Little mm-hmm. Dunkirk action. That's where that was fought at, too. There's the most intense fighting in the Guadalcanal campaign of Prolong happened in that small area. And mm-hmm. I was listening to this tour group, and one of the tour group persons basically told me that their tour guide, U.S. tour guide group, said, well, nothing really happened in this area. And I was thinking back, I said, well, just in my vision here, I can see where 2 Medal of Honors occurred and a number of Navy crosses and intense fighting. So they hit that area and they got bogged down. There was one Marine named Anthony Casamento. Mm-hmm. He earned a Medal of Honor, and he was later presented in 1980 by Jimmy Carter, because there was no witnesses around. And Casamento earned his Medal of Honor at that area, too. But anyway,
he was a machine gunner, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was a machine gunner. And I think in their last episode, or mm-hmm. one of the episodes, we've done a few now, I mentioned there were 5 Medal of Honors earned on Guadalcanal by enlisted men, and all 5 were machine gunners mm-hmm. on land.
Mm-hmm. And Dave, that was second only to Iwo for Marines?
I don't know.
Is that right?
Possibly, yeah. If I think back on it, I mean, 6-month campaign. I mean, it was, I think officially it was 21 Medal of Honors. Not all mm-hmm. by Marines, it was Army and Navy.
Sure.
Earned at Guadalcanal.
Yeah.
There was probably I can't think of another campaign that many were earned.
Mm-hmm. Not on one place.
And but. Seth, in your opening, you referred to the 164th Marines. Of course, that's how they referred to themselves. Right. They were the 164th Infantry Regiment, though. Mm-hmm. And they weren't here yet, were they?
No, they were here. They were here.
Okay.
Because remember, we discussed them in the October battle. They arrived on the 13th, right. Now the battleship. Yep. Mm-hmm. So they were the only U.S. Army ground unit there at the time. So everything was going well for the Marines. I mean, after 1-5 got a setback, 2-5 and 3-5 basically circled the Japanese in a pocket at Point Cruz and eliminated the Japanese, about 350. So the offensive was going quite well. The Japanese didn't have any really other troops on the ground, and they were on the back foot, and the Marines were pushing all the way, and they would have went to Cucumbono. But Naval Intelligence, Ultra, radio intercepts basically said that the Japanese were going to land a whole division at Coley Point. And Coley Point is east of the perimeter. Now, all this action was happening west of the perimeter around the Matanica and Point Cruz.
Mm-hmm. So in theory, this would be behind the Marine lines then?
Well, kind of on the eastern flank of the Marines and the western flank. So at this stage, Vandegrift, because you had more than a reinforced division on scene, the western sector he gave to a general called General Seabury, and he was mm-hmm. the assistant division commander of the Maricao Division. So he was on the island then, U.S. Army. And take that back. The western part was given to General Rupertus, who was the assistant commander of the 1st Marine Division.
1st Division, yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, it's 4:20 in the morning. I'll reset that. So
Seabury
was the western sector commander. And you've got Rupertus was the eastern sector commander. So he divided it. So intel said they were landing at Coley Point in the 38th Division. Mm-hmm. So Vandegrift hadn't left that many troops in the perimeter around the airfield. So obviously he had to stop the offensive happening out west and send some troops to the east to see what was happening at Coley Point. The only troops he really had was the 7th Marines. And obviously they were very, very spent because they had fought very hard in the October battles, but that's all he had. So he stopped the offensive. He didn't pull them back at that stage, but he stopped the offensive. And the Japanese intelligence later in Japanese reports after the battle said if the Marines and part of that had one battalion of the 164th then involved in that, if they would have kept pushing, they would have probably almost ended the campaign there. They would have really pushed all the way as far as they wanted to go. So it was on a thread that the Japanese held due to the fact that the intel was saying the 38th, the whole division was going to land on Vandegrift's east flank. So that mm-hmm. sets up the Battle of Coley Point.
Yeah, and the Japanese do wind up bringing these people eventually to that area or near that general vicinity. And it is indeed the 38th Infantry Division, as well as part of the 229th Infantry Regiment, I believe, is what the Japanese. This is going to be one of the last, excuse me, this is going to be one of the last major reinforcements. I say major, I mean, it's a pretty good, sizable amount of people that the Japanese are bringing to the island. This is one of the last major reinforcements that they try to undertake. And there's many reasons why that occurs, of which, not the least of which, are the sea battles that are occurring at the same time. Well, let's talk about Coley Point, Dave. What's going on out there? They sense the Vandegrift sends the 7th Marines. He sends some other people out there, and he also sends later on some of the 2nd Raider Battalion. 2nd Raider Battalion, of course, is under Evans Carlson, and they're coming into the island here in a little bit later. But let's talk about Coley. What's going on out there?
Well, Coley Point's probably maybe 8, maybe 10 miles to the east of Henderson Field. So Coley Point was the area that some of the Japanese had been landing earlier, a little bit further east. I mean, you had the Ichiki, Kawaguchi. They landed at Tavu Point, which isn't too far from Coley Point into the village of Teteri, where all this was occurring. So, yeah, you mentioned the Japanese regiment that was involved with the 2nd Division in their assault on the Battle of Henderson Field in late October. That was the right flank, the one that really didn't get heavily involved in a fight under Colonel Soji. So they ended up at Coley Point, and they were based there. So the Japanese plan was to land a whole division, as we mentioned earlier, the 38th Division at Coley Point. But then right before they could land, they changed their plans because they said, well, if we land a whole division on the east side, we can't, you know, we're having issues and problems supplying our guys to the west of the perimeter. So if we land a whole division to the east, how are we really going to supply them? We'll have split forces and we can't support each other. So they're going to land at a small token of probably about 300 or 400 troops at Coley Point. Mm-hmm. And the rest of the division was slated to land where the Japanese had been landing earlier at Cape Esperance on the western flank. West side. Yeah, on the left side. If you look at Hendersfield, you got left and right. So left is west and right is east. So you had roughly about 3,000 Japanese there in total. So they'd landed, and 2nd Battalion of the 7th Marines under H.H. Hennekin, you know, the famous Banana War Marine, Lieutenant Colonel, they were there, and that's what Vandegrift sent them out to find out what was going on. So they were actually, I forget which day. Anyway, it was early November. So they were basically assaulted by a small group of Japanese, and then had to withdraw. But the radios weren't working quite well, which is, you know, quite common, and they didn't get the word back. But Vandegrift and the rest of the division high command knew something was happening. So they dispatched the 1st Battalion, 2nd Marines under Puller again to find out what was going. And they dispatched 2 battalions of the 164th U.S. Army Regiment. And this was the first time they were going to go on the offensive. You know, they've, as we discussed in Battle of Henderson Field, they did quite well in the defensive positions, repelling those Japanese assaults.
Yeah.
So you had him under Rupertus. He was given, once again, he'd given command, and they were in a maneuver to try to trap these Japanese in there and wipe them out.
Yeah, and, you know, it's important you mentioned the 164th because they're now a blooded unit. You know, they've seen combat. They've seen a lot of combat. They've seen that heavy, heavy action at the end of October there. They've been involved in patrolling actions. So, I mean, this is their first, they're a tried and tested unit. And as we're going to see when we start talking about more about the Army offensives here in just a few minutes, is that some of the Army units, the other Army units that are either on the island or are coming to the island, don't have anywhere near the same performance level that the 164th do, certainly at this time and then even later on. So before
we jump off of that, Dave, if you could, you know, help us understand here we had an Army regiment that was attached to a Marine division, the 1st Marine Division, is that correct? Yeah. You know, then that happens on and off throughout the war. I don't know of any time when Marine regiments were attached to Army divisions, do you?
Yes, in this campaign, and we'll discuss it toward the end, is a whole division. It's a combined division of Marines and Army.
Attached to AmeriCal?
No, they're called the CAM division. It was just a hybrid division they formed for about 2 or 3 weeks on Guadalcanal.
Okay.
But yeah, just to rack my brain real quick. I know there was auxiliary Marine units attached to Army, mainly Corps elements.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I don't think of a regiment.
When the AmeriCal, when the Army AmeriCal division comes in, it's 100% Army though.
Yes.
That's,
yes. It's a, the, okay. The 23rd is the officially we're known, 23rd U.S. Army Division, but the AmeriCal formed the New Caledonia.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they're...
Yeah, all, these order of battle issues sometimes become confusing. Here you have 164th Army Infantry Regiment, but they're part of the 1st Marine Division, and that's an important point to keep in mind.
Yeah, you'll see in the Guadalcanal campaign, just like the Cactus Air Force, I mean, everything was hybrid. And the guys worked, and all the services worked together. I mean, I think there was a... out of necessity that, you know, we're here now. We have to work together. I mean, all the put aside our...
People believe that jointness began with Goldwater Nichols in the 1980s, and this is kind of the point. We were doing jointness very, very well, even in World War II. We actually started regressing and overcomplicating it over time. But this is not...
A lot of the units, you know, as to Dave's point, you know, I mean, there were ad hoc units that were put together. So you're talking, like, we talk about the Raiders and the paratroopers. You know, those guys were combined at Edson's Ridge. They were combined into, you know, essentially one, I don't want to say large, but, you know, larger fighting force. So this happens a lot, especially on Guadalcanal, because you, at certain times you were scraping the bottom of the barrel. You had to use whatever you had to use, you know. But the situation for the United States, at least at this point, is turning significantly better than it had been, you know, even a month before. So the offensive around Coley Point goes pretty well. You know, you talked about Chesty Puller, and Chesty Puller at this time, his Marines, his 1-7 Marines are, they're worn out. I mean, they're tired. You know, they've taken some casualties. You know, they've taken some, you know, everybody on Guadalcanal has got friggin' dysentery and or malaria at the same damn time. So these guys are, they're tuckered out, but Puller again leads his people into action. He gets wounded here, does he not, Dave? Chesty?
Yes, it's the only, what's 38 years of combat service or Marine service. It's the only time in his whole history he was ever wounded. Mm-hmm. He's wounded here at Guadalcanal. He was, they were moving, they were on the left flank of Puller, and they were in a thick jungle in the coconut groves, and he's got his command group. And as we discussed earlier, Puller always liked to be up front, and he couldn't see anything. He's trying to work out what was going on. And the Japanese had landed a 70 millimeter, I think it might have been when there's 77 millimeters. Anyway, it was a small field gun.
Field piece.
Yeah, and they landed one. And it, Gavava Creek is the area. Not too many people who visit Guadalcanal even know where Gavava Creek or even go there, but I used to take a few people there. And that was the pocket they had the Japanese trapped in. And Puller couldn't, to see what was going on, he'd moved out onto the beach with his command group. And obviously, once they hit the beach, a whole command group with the radios and, you know, a cluster of guys trying to find out what was going on. That was a prime target for that Japanese field gun. So the Japanese field gun took a shot and hit Puller's command group. Killed a few and severely wounded Puller. He got a lot of shrapnel in him. There's a couple of versions in the Burt Davis book. He says Puller was then shot by a rifle. But then in John Hoffman's book, which is a friend of mine, John, he's, I think it's the definitive biography. Called Chesty on Puller, mentions that it was just shrapnel. And what Puller didn't, Puller being Puller, didn't like go out of the fight at that stage. He was wounded, severely wounded. The radio wire, the field phone wire was cut. And Puller being Puller crawled out and fixed it on his own, repaired the wire, crawled back under command, trying to get some artillery fire because had some of the 10th Marine artillery from the 2nd Marine Division in support. So they got enough artillery fire, and they got enough fire suppression to suppress that. And then Puller refused to be evacuated. Once again, he was severely wounded and had shrapnel. He goes, well, I can still fight. I think he said something to the words that, you know, when I grew up in Virginia, there was enough old men walking around with Yankee rust in them or Yankee lead. You know, I can survive or something. Words to that effect of Puller being Puller. But he remained during the night. You know, they dug in for the night, and then the next morning he could barely walk, and he couldn't function anymore. And then he said, "Look, I can't turn my command over to my captain. He's a junior captain." So they sent, I think, a major up from the perimeter to take over. And Puller said, look, I won't be carried onto the landing craft. I'll walk. So he hobbled onto the landing craft. They took him back to the perimeter, and they performed surgery on him. They left a bit of shrapnel in him. And that was the saying. He said, the doctor said, look, we need to, I think, evacuate you back in New Caledonia to remove this.
For more surgery.
Yeah, big piece of metal. And I think that's when he said, look, you know, there was enough old men living, one running around when I was a little boy would rust in them so I can survive. And he did. He kept that piece of metal. And then I think you'll discuss when you get to Peleliu how this old war wound from Guadalcanal come back to haunt him a bit, because it was severely affected his
physically and maybe psychologically as well at Peleliu.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't want to get too far into the weeds with Peleliu now, but I mean, you know, Chesty Puller's a legendary character or figure, and he earned the reputation that he has to this day. However, if there's one blemish in his record, and I've said this before, it is definitely his command of 1st Regiment at Peleliu. Yeah. He, you know, and you got to wonder, Dave, to your point, was it, I mean, it was hot as blue Hades on Peleliu the entire time. You know, he's suffering with a recurring war wound from Guadalcanal. You know, his men are being killed by the bushel on Peleliu, and you got to wonder if it was a combination of a lot of things that just wore the man down and caused him to make the decisions that frankly killed a lot of Marines on yeah. Peleliu. But that's
another episode. But yeah. But back to this injury and this whole performance, Dave, you would think that, I think you received another Navy Cross after this action. Is that right?
No, he didn't. I think he received only a Bronze Star and, of course, a Purple Heart. Right?
Incredible, right? I mean, this is like close to Medal of Honor level performance. And did that conversation ever take place? And people recognize him as the most decorated Marine in history, even though he never received a Medal of Honor. But in aggregate, boy, oh boy, there's almost nobody who's done as much or put up with as much as Chesty Puller, is there?
Well, there was, I don't think I mentioned it in the last episode of Battle of Henderson Field, but Puller was actually recommended for a Medal of Honor. Mm-hmm. The only time in his career that I'm aware of, and it was recommended at regimental level for his performance that later earned him his 3rd Navy Cross. And it was put up to division level, and they knocked it back. They downgraded it to a Navy Cross. Well, he was actually, because there's been, you know, throughout the years, there have been, you know, calls and requests to have one of his Navy Crosses upgraded to the Medal of Honor.
Yeah.
But he was actually recommended for the Medal of Honor for that that battle.
It's, so, you know, we've talked about this before with different guys being recommended for Medal of Honor and either getting, you know, Navy Cross or Distinguished Service Cross, whatever the case may be. And, you know, some guys got the medal and it was like, you know, maybe that action deserved a Navy Cross, but there are certain actions. I think Puller's command of 1-7 at Henderson Field specifically was certainly worthy of a Medal of Honor. I mean, that's my personal opinion. If he was going to ever get it, that would have been the time. And you got to kind of wonder why he didn't, you know.
Yeah, I never made sense of that. No. It's almost like somebody had a, you know, prejudice against him or something like that. I'm not sure exactly. Thought that he's already enough of a legend, he doesn't need to be more. But, or, you know, and to some extent, I think there was a, in the Marine Corps, not true in the Navy, where commanding officers did receive Medals of Honor routinely, there was kind of a bias towards presenting it to enlisted men, I think, in the Marine Corps, more so than officers.
I don't know. You see, you look at a lot of the Marines that earned the Medal of Honor, I mean, all the way through the war, and there's a great, I would say the enlisted man population outranks the officer population at least 2-1.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And in particular, in the Navy, a submarine skipper might, or, you know, carrier skipper might have received a Medal of Honor for some action. Right. That almost never happened to my knowledge that the commanding officer in the Marine Corps did.
Right.
Other than Vandegrift.
Vandegrift is one example.
Good point. Yeah.
Almost never, not never.
Almost never. Yeah. So, Dave, there's another unit that's involved in this kind of after the action here at Coley Point. Well, it's not really after. It's a part of it, but it's later. And we haven't talked about these guys yet, and they do deserve conversation. And this is the 2nd Raider Battalion. You know, we've talked about the 1st Raider Battalion ad nauseum, Edson's people. This is Carlson. This is Evans Carlson's Raider Battalion. They'd been on Guadalcanal. They hadn't been on there very, very long. They had seen action, of course, during the Macon Island raid in August of 42, where, and we could do a whole episode on that alone, which is, it, that's a fascinating event in Marine Corps history that, frankly, went south pretty quick. Evans Carlson almost got his whole command killed and captured, but that's another conversation from another episode. But the 2nd Raider Battalion is now here on Guadalcanal under Carlson, and they execute what is known to history as the Long Patrol. It's probably their defining moment, the 2nd Raider Battalion, of the entire war. Lay it on us. What is or was the Long Patrol? Why was it executed? And we can get into the, you know, what happened and everything here in just a few minutes, but what, why were they sent out there, and what were they trying to do?
Yeah, so this wraps up Cully Point. It initiated the 2nd Raider. So at Cully Point, the 7th Marines and 164th had formed a perimeter, and they were going to wipe these Japanese out at Gavava Creek. And the 164th, being kind of new at maneuvering, didn't close the bottom of the pocket, so to speak, and they left a small gap, which allowed Colonel Soji and majority of the regiment to escape. So they were going to escape and move back to the Matanikau River and join the rest of the Japanese there. So they left about 450 Japanese as a rear guard, and they probably punched out about 2,500 Japanese escape. So there's a bit of controversy with the two army battalions, and they said they were slow in the first maneuvering. But anyway, those Japanese escaped. So Admiral Turner, throughout the campaign, always wanted to use the Marines in all kind of different ways. And Vandegrift was, to Vandegrift and the rest of the division commands, frustration. But they wanted to form airfield at a place called Ayola, which is further down to the east. It was one of the provincial British colonial offices pre-war, where Martin Clemens, the famous coast watcher, was at. So Ayola was flat. They're going to put a big airfield there. So landed some CBs, the 147th U.S. Army Infantry Regiment, and the 2nd Raiders there at Ayola to start building this airfield. And the engineers had landed there before, and some of the 2nd Marines had landed there before, and they basically said, you can't build an airfield here due to it's too swampy and a number of other factors. So they pulled the plug there, but it allowed the 2nd Raiders, once those Japanese had escaped the pocket, the Raiders were a bit further east, and Vandegrift, or Evans Carlson, the Raider commander, landed in the perimeter, and they said, we got a mission for you and your Raiders. Follow these guys and harass them and just see where they're going, and just constantly just harass. That's what you're designed to do, to operate behind the lines and do guerrilla-style tactics, and that was what Carlson and his guys excelled in, patterned after the Chinese. Mm-hmm. So that was their mission, to follow this column of 2,500 Japanese all the way to Mount Austin. Yeah. So they were given that mission to follow them.
How many Raiders were there? I'm sorry?
Sorry?
How many Raiders was in this unit?
So it was probably a battalion, so probably a Raider battalion, maybe 600 or 700. Okay. And initially there was, I think he had three companies. And they wouldn't have a full complement, because I think he had two other companies that hadn't landed yet. Yeah. Potentially three to four companies. There were smaller Raiders were smaller companies than the normal Marine infantry regiment or battalion.
So they go out. They being the Raiders, they make this trek, and as you say, Dave, to your point, they're essentially following these Japanese, and they're at certain points getting ahead of them and cutting different groups of them off. They're out there for how many days? I mean, it's a long time. It's not like a 2-day patrol. I mean, hence the reason they call it the Long Patrol. But still,
about 30 days.
Yeah, that's a hell of a long time to be behind enemy lines. I mean, when these guys got to Guadalcanal, they were in, I don't want to say, peak physical condition, because I don't think anybody who got to Guadalcanal was in peak physical condition, but they were in better shape than most of the Marines that were there, because they were relatively fresh. When they got out of the jungle after this, I mean, these guys were bad off, man. I mean, they were walking out, but I mean, they were, I mean, like, kind of to my point, what I said before, I don't think there was a single one of them that didn't have malaria and dysentery, and then they were really bad off. They'd been supplied with food and ammunition, but not to the point where being, you know, healthy.
No, no.
And I mean,
Carlson, you know, once again, he patterned themselves after the Chinese. He learned from the Chinese. So they had a sock full of rice and raisins. And he said, we'll eat like the Asians eat in the Chinese. And you know, once again, they're kind of starving themselves from the get-go.
Yeah.
Dave, is this the same Carlson that led a group of raiders on a submarine launched assault of Macon Island?
Evans Carlson. And the exile was the Jimmy Roosevelt, which was the president's son.
Yeah. So the second Raider Battalion had a lot of talent in it, and it wasn't, frankly, I'll probably get a little flack for this. It didn't have the talent that the first Raider Battalion did in terms of leadership. Evans Carlson.
You're going to get a little flack for that.
It is what it is. I mean, the proof is in the pudding. I mean, I don't care what people say, it's there. I mean, Evans Carlson was a polarizing figure, and, you know, not necessarily, although he was polarizing politically, but that's not what we're here to talk about. But if you go back and you look at the history of the Macon Island raid, I mean, he really did. He damn near got his entire command killed and captured. It was United States press, you know, pumped it up to be a big success, and it really, really, really wasn't. There's still Marines buried on Macon Island. But
that was while we were landing on Guadalcanal, as I recall.
It was an early kick in August, yeah. It was in August of 42.
Incredible.
But my point in all this is that they performed well. The enlisted men performed, and the officers performed well, but it at a great cost to the 2nd Raider Battalion physically and emotionally. When they got out of the jungle, when they came back to the Marine perimeter, they were done, man. And I mean, that's pretty much all you hear from them on Guadalcanal is this patrol, because it just sucked the life right out of them. But on the positive side, on the plus side of this, they eliminated between 400 and 500 Japanese. At least that's the claim from the Raiders.
Yeah, almost 600 they were talking about. They lost 16 Raiders. A lot of these Japanese, they killed them on the side of the trails or in hospital beds. Mm-hmm. Obviously, they didn't take any prisoners. They're behind the lines. A lot of the Japanese were, you know, wounded and sick and diseased.
Right.
And they used to just harass the Japanese. They'd find the Japanese sleeping, or they'd find them and just harass them. And obviously, I had to mention Solomon Islander scouts. You had Jacob Vuza, the famous Solomon Islander. So they were leading the Raiders. You'll see a lot of the photos. And I think they had something like 50 Solomon Islanders between scouts and porters. Mm-hmm. And they were the real instrumental. And they would find the Japanese, and the Raiders would just kill them all.
Yeah. And I mean, this is, you know, kind of par for the course for the Japanese when they're pulling out of a position, you know, back from Henderson Field, Edson's Ridge, Coley Point, the Matanikau. When they're pulling back through the jungle, they're leaving their dead and dying behind by the bushels. And you said yourself that you can even sometimes still find remnants of the Japanese along the trails today, right?
Yes, there still remains everywhere. I mean, once the jungle, you can just dig in the jungle. I guess covering a jungle floor, as you call it, and yes, you would find the remains of weapons and human remains and all kind of things.
No, I mean, the jungle was almost the Japanese worst enemy, frankly, at some points in the Guadalcanal campaign. Well, let's move on. Let's move up a little bit forward here. Let's talk about some of these final actions that occur on land and here at Guadalcanal, some of the final large actions that occur. Talk about the Japanese supply situation. Now, the Japanese supply situation on Guadalcanal was infamously poor, and that's putting it mildly. By December 1942, that supply state had reached an absolute critical point. You know, the Japanese Navy, the Imperial Navy, had basically shot the works in trying to resupply the Japanese soldiers that were there because, you know, they'd been defeated numerous times at sea. Only about 12,000, my numbers are saying, only about 12,000 of the reported 20,000 Japanese on the island were fit for duty. And frankly, that number itself is arguable. And the reason for that, of course, is malnutrition, disease, wounds, you know, suffered in battle and different things like that. I mean, these guys, the Japanese that were there, for the most part, were, and I'm not, you know, I mean, they were skeletons of their former selves. I mean, they were in horrible physical shape. They could still fight, as we'll see, but they were in horrible, horrible, horrible physical shape. That being said, on the United States side of things, the tables have completely turned, and that, you know, the U.S. is getting supplies by the literally by the shipload, not daily, but we're getting large, large supply transports coming in. They're dumping, you know, basically, you know, unmolested, you know, dropping off supplies and people. This is, you know, completely opposite of what the Japanese are experiencing. You know, anytime they try to land anything at all, they're harassed by Cactus Air Force, or they're shot up by, you know, American destroyers or PT boats or what have you. You know, I mean, they're harassed constantly. There's more facilities that are sprouting up around the American perimeter now. You know, there's all kinds of support facilities that were never there that would have only been pipe dreams to the poor Marines in October. I mean, literally, like even 2 months before, these would have been, you know, something, a fever dream that one of these Marines would have had. But now they got all these things that are starting to pop up. And, you know, typical of the United States Marine Corps, as these, quote, luxuries are starting to pop up, the 1st Marine Division is pulled out of there. So as some of the, yeah, and believe me, you know, as you and I've talked about many, many times, I knew a lot of guys that were in the 1st Division on Guadalcanal, and they were like, see you later, when they got the hell out of there. They couldn't have been happier to leave that damn place.
All those supplies did nothing to override the fact that many of them, maybe most of them, had malaria and dysentery, right? So they got some medical attention, but they were still suffering.
You know, and that's something we've never really talked about in any of these episodes that we've done on Guadalcanal, is the physical state of the Marines. We talked about the supply situation. We talked mm-hmm. about the combat, obviously, ad nauseum. But something we never really talked about is the physical state of these guys. I forget the exact numbers, but the ratio was something like 3 to 1. And it may have been more, that there were three times as many Marines that were put down by disease than by Japanese gunfire. Dave, do you remember the exact ratio? But I want to say it was like 3 to 1, wasn't it? Or something, or very close to that.
Well, as you know, malaria takes a few weeks to right. kick in. So by October of 42, there are about 2,000 reported cases mm-hmm. in the division. And by November, there was over 3,000 reported cases. And I think when they left the island, it was something like 8,000 all up. Marines had malaria. And then once they reached Australia, because some of them were taking any malaria suppressants,
mm-hmm.
the ones that were when they had it. Yeah, when they had it. And then obviously they quit taking it when they got to Australia. Then it really kicked in and recurring, as you know, malaria recurs. So they were very physically spent. And even today, you go to Guadalcanal without people shooting at you, whatever, and it's quote modern. And you'd still get malaria, you still get dengue fever. You go out in the jungle, just living in the jungle a week, and you're physically spent. These guys are there for 4 months. And there was no rest and relaxation area on Guadalcanal. If they sent you back to the R&R section, that was the middle of the V-ring. That's where you got the daily bombings and the naval bombardment. That was right. where the rest area was. So right. there was no break from it.
Right. Yeah. I knew a guy named Frank Pomeroy, who was H Company 2nd Battalion 1st. He was one of the guys at Tenaru River. And he talked about the rest areas on Guadalcanal. And I use air quotes with that, rest areas. And they were usually their rest areas, and their rest time were working parties. And for them, for specifically Frank, they were talking about working parties where they were filling in holes on the airfield. So, you know, there was no downtime on Guadalcanal, yeah. really. You know, if you weren't getting shot at, you were working, and if you weren't getting shot at and working, you were sweating and shivering and shaking from malaria. So it was a miserable existence for those people. And yeah. and you know, they get pulled off in December. And I know, Dave, recently you posted on your Facebook page a couple of pictures of those Marines being pulled off of the island. And I mean, you know, there were guys that lost upwards of 40 and 50 pounds or more from just malnutrition, stress, you know, tropical diseases. You know, of course, there's the famous stories of when they're being pulled, literally physically pulled aboard the transport ships to get them out of the area, that they had to be physically pulled up the rope nets. Yeah, because they did not have the strength to climb up the nets. That's shown in the miniseries Pacific, but that's true. You know, that's a true thing. These guys were spent. So when they left Guadalcanal, they waved goodbye.
Yeah, there's some footage that shows the Marines, and from those photos were still shots from the footage, and just the ramps on the landing craft. I remember there was one scene there that he couldn't get up the ramp to the landing craft. and had to pull him over the ramp of the landing craft. It was only about 3 foot high.
Yeah, they were done. They were done. But when the first Marine Division's when they're getting the hell out of Guadalcanal, there's a lot of other units that are coming in, mostly Army. They're 182nd and 132nd Infantry Regiment of the AmeriCal Division come and join their brothers from the 164th there. They come ashore in November and December, respectively. The 147th Infantry Regiment of the Army, as well as the 2nd Marine, as you said, Dave, the 2nd Marine Division's 8th Marines are coming ashore in November. They're coming a little bit earlier. There's artillery, tons of artillery now, construction facilities, aviation facilities out the wazoo, additional support elements, including, you know, CBs that you talked about and things like that. Guadalcanal, and this is something that I think people need to understand, is what, you know, you look at Guadalcanal in September, August, September, October, and it's, you know, like, you know, Privation Island. There's like no support facilities, nothing. By the end of the hell, by the middle of 43, Guadalcanal is like the major training base in the South Pacific for the United States. It's huge. And there's all kinds of support facilities.
A lot of facilities,
by the way. Yeah, tons.
And one of those soldiers who came ashore mid-November was part of the 57th Combat Engineer Regiment, was a Corporal Joseph Talone, who, you know, a whole bunch of people, Seth, that I don't. One guy I knew was Joseph Talone because it was my uncle. And so I don't know if they augmented the CBs or replaced the CBs, but he was there from mid-November, I think, until they got transshipped to go to the next battle. Damn. He ended up just 2 years later as a master sergeant, from corporal to master sergeant in 2 years during the Philippine operation. But
that'll show you the attrition rate too, to get that kind of promotion in that's short,
right,
amount of time. On December 9th, 1942, United States Army General Alexander Patch succeeds Marine General Vandegrift as overall commander of Guadalcanal forces. Vandegrift, of course, leaves when his beloved 1st Marine Division leaves as well. By the end of the month of December, what's left of the 1st Marine Division is gone. I think the 5th Marines are the first ones out of there, aren't they, Dave?
Yes.
Yeah, and then they're followed by the 1st Marines and then the 7th Marines. I think the 7th Marines are the last ones to go, fittingly, because they're the last ones.
And the poor 2nd Marines.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, if you remember, they were the one that augmented the 1st Marines. And they in fact, the 2nd Marines were the first ones to land in the Guadalcanal campaign.
Right.
And they were officially part of the 2nd Marine Division, so they had to remain it. But they left in January.
Yeah.
They weren't impressed.
so now that Alexander or Archer or Alexander, however you want to say, General Vandegrift is gone, Patch is now he's the head banana. He's in command. One of his first orders that he is given is to eliminate what is left of the Japanese. You know, this is a very broad order, very easy to say, very difficult to do. Once he gets this order, he requests more troops, and naturally, and those troops that do come are what is going to be known as Tropic Lightning. That's the 25th Infantry Division. They arrive, and they augment the Army troops there. Now, one of the first major Army actions is to eliminate the Japanese around Mount Austin. This is an offensive that is undertaken because of major Japanese infiltration tactics. Dave, they're harassing a lot of the Army lines and some of the supply dumps and the airfield to a point, or airfields plural to a point. And Patch has had enough of this stuff, and he decides, he's like, all right, we're going to get rid of these people and let's do this. And the Army, as we'll see here in the next few minutes, the Army has a lot to learn, don't they?
Yeah, so Mount Austin, that was always, in fact, that was one of the first objectives when the Marines landed, you know, the grassy knoll.
They
found out it was a bit further than they were anticipated. So there's always a thorn in their side, because the observation of the airfields and the landing, all the beaches and everything, and they wanted to wipe it out, but Vandegrift never had the resources, so he just kind of left it in place. So as you said, Patch was given a command, wipe out the Japanese or eliminate Japanese on the island. The head U.S. Army General Harmon, U.S. Army General, Major General Harmon, from the South Pacific, had actually landed on the island. He wasn't in charge, but he was the overall commander. Patch was in charge. So The U.S. Army wanted to continue their offensive past Matanikau, Port Cruz, all the way to the end of the island. But they knew that left flank, they knew there were some Japanese up there. They didn't think there were many on Mount Austin. That was to be their left flank. And it would be obviously, if you had your left flank exposed. So let's just wipe out those Japanese on the left flank. And also, like you just mentioned, there was some infiltration tactics. The Japanese were coming down on Fighter 2. Auxiliary field destroyed, I think, a couple of P-39s, some fuel dumps. So he said, look, let's just wipe those guys out. So he tasked the 132nd Infantry Regiment to do this. They just landed on the island for about a week at that stage. It really wasn't acclimatized. They're a brand new regiment. He says this is a good blooding or testing ground for these guys. There's probably about 200 remnants or maybe 150, 200 Japanese up there, because they'd done some patrolling and didn't find really many Japanese abandoned positions. So it gave the 132nd the task of eliminating the Japanese on Mount Austin. And then once they eliminated him, then they were going to push through with his two division attack to the west, hold one division, leave one division back to hold the airfield, and had the other two divisions. By that stage, majority of the 2nd Marine Division had landed, not all of them. And that was going to be the plan.
Yeah. That's the plan. Well, you know, the plan doesn't always, you know, as I forget what Bill's famous
statement. Contact with the enemy.
There it is.
Plan never survives contact with the enemy.
That's it. That's it. So, like, to Dave's point, that the 132nd selected for this assault, initial probing attacks are met with fierce Japanese resistance, and that fierce Japanese resistance essentially stops the United States Army, boom, right in its tracks.
It's not just infantry, right? There's still Japanese artillery on the island.
Oh yeah, oh for sure. And it's an inauspicious start to this assault, to this offensive here, is that the Army's, you know, this, as Dave said, it's a brand new unit, but still, they meet the enemy and they're halted for several days, right, Dave? I mean, they're held up there for a couple of days. It's not until Christmas Eve that they actually start renewing their attacks again, right?
Yeah, so they moved up. They lost one of the battalion commanders from the 3rd Battalion, the lead up, Lieutenant Colonel Wright. So if you go to Guadalcanal today, there's the road leading up to Mount Austin. It's called Wright Road, named after him. So they lost the battalion commander. What the Japanese had a place called the Gifu. The Gifu was the very top of Mount Austin. It was a 1,500-yard horseshoe-shaped reinforced coconut log bunker, supporting bunkers, probably about 50 bunkers. They dug in there. Most of these bunkers were, like I said, well camouflaged, had two or three machine guns apiece in them. About 500 Japanese were up there. That was old friend Colonel Oka and his guys up there in the 124th and the 228th Regiment. They were dug in heavily. So what the Japanese had planned to do, that was the most heavily defensive fortified position in the Guadalcanal campaign. So the Japanese said, look, we'll go on the defensive right now because we expect to have the 38th Division, the 51st Division. There was all these plans in place to renew their offenses. So at this stage, what we need to do is to dig in, hold that area with what we've got, because we can't go on the offensive like you mentioned before because we don't have that capability, get further troops in there, and then renew our offensive. So they dug in very heavily up there. And the Army, when they hit the Japanese, they went in and had to go into the jungle. And there's reports from some of the vets, they didn't even see the Japanese bunkers till they're 3 to 4 to 5 feet away. Then they opened up on them. And they were mutually supporting. And then what they kept committing in one battalion, then the 2nd battalion. They had 2 battalions. They kept moving to the left flank and tried to find the Japanese perimeter. They kept extending the line to left, the 132nd regimental commander. And then they finally found out the Japanese have a full extended perimeter, horseshoe-shaped perimeter. So they dug in. The Americans dug in. The Japanese dug in. They faced each other. And this went on for a period of about 4 weeks. They dug in. And at one stage, the one battalion of the 132nd, they'd found a way behind the Japanese, the Hill 27. So if you go to my videos, I got one called Hill 27 in the Gifu. And Hill 27 looks exactly like it is today. So they moved one battalion. They come up behind the Japanese on Hill 27. It was unmanned. And they had a Japanese had a 70-millimeter mountain gun up there. And it was sitting by itself. The crew was in the shade about 70 yards away, they said. So they came over, surprised them, killed the crew, and they dug in. The Japanese had like 6 counterattacks to try to push them off. And the Japanese couldn't do it. So at that stage, they had enclosed the Gifu. Then the Japanese had only one supply trail that was on the western side, and it's straight down into the Matanikau River Valley. So at least they knew the 132nd by the end of December, the 132nd had enclosed those Japanese there. So that I guess, threat to Patch's left flank was secured. But the 132nd was basically spent.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, and that's a good point. That's something I want to touch on real briefly here. You know, the Hill 27 action, you know, they take the hill, like you said, and the Americans suffer significant casualties out there in that area. It's about 115 killed in action and a further 272 wounded in action just from the United States side alone. And you said the jungle, you know, and the terrain and the perimeter and not the perimeter, I'm sorry, the jungle, the terrain and the weather and the humidity and the heat and the disease and everything else, it affects the army troops significantly there. And it's very similar to what's happening or what happened to the Japanese previous, and that, you know, from their offensives, the Japanese are pulling back through the jungle, and there's still people, even though they're not getting shot anymore, they're dying in the jungle. They're dying because of the wounds and the diseases and everything that they're being exposed to. Well, the same thing's happening here to the army. Granted, not to the extent that it was happening to the Japanese, but we lost a lot of people after the fact because of the jungle, trying to get in out of the jungle. You know, these guys are dying along the trail. And that's something I don't think people realize, is that, you know, the United States Army suffered a fate in this particular action that is eerily similar to what the Japanese suffered on almost every single assault that they ever had on Guadalcanal. And it proves to the average listener, viewer, whatever you want to call it, that Guadalcanal itself was an enemy to everybody that set foot on it. Yeah, it wasn't just the Japanese that suffered. It wasn't just the 1st Marine Division. If you were a human being and you had 2 feet on Guadalcanal, at some point you were suffering that island's kicking your ass at some point in your existence while you're there.
And so what was the last battle where we lost 115 KIA on Guadalcanal?
This is Hill 27. Well, that Mount Austin.
Before area. That, had we lost that many KIA in one battle?
I don't think in one battle.
Well, around that, we should have mentioned, we could backtrack now. After the Coley Point action, the Marines and the Army renewed their offensive at Point Cruz. Mm-hmm. And remember, the Japanese, if the Marines and the Army had continued pushing with Vandegrift, they would have probably went to the Poha River, but they had to withdraw back for the actions at Coley Point. So in about mid-November, they renewed their offensive. Once again, this is the Point Cruz line that no one even knows about. And they hit those hills at Point Cruz, the 164th, mainly, and the 182nd had arrived at that stage, and the 8th Marines, and they basically butted ahead against these Japanese defenses around Point Cruz on the hills there. The Japanese had those reverse slope defenses. They had the draws, which went north or north and south, and the Marines, and they had machine gun bunkers on the bottom of the jungle floors and enfilade fire. So the 164th, the 182nd and the 8th Marines lost over 100. I think the 164th lost over 100 something, like 120, 100, over 100 KIA in that short time, just butting heads against that. And that they dug in on that line. That was called the Point Cruz line. Mm-hmm. And the Marines and the U.S. at least had a permanent, I guess, position on the west side of Matanikau in the first time in the campaign. But they dug in there for 6 weeks. So if you go there today, and it's roughly the same area where the ravine was, where Puller, where Monroe, all that area. And once again, like I discussed before, when you go there today, no one really talks about that Point Cruz line. And that was a heavy, heavy fight. The 164th, basically, that was, if you speak to a 164th veteran, they won't say the Battle of the Henderson Field was their hardest time. They say that Point Cruz fights on those hills is the hardest fight. That went all the way up until, December. Late December. So when all that fighting was happening at Mount Austin, some of the fighting was still happening daily around the Point Cruz line, almost like a World War I style fight.
Yes, and kind of almost like a never ending back and forth. After the stalemate, really, is, you know, right near there around Mount Austin. There's another couple of instances in which the Army tangles with the Japanese at some odd named places, Galloping Horse, Seahorse, places like that. And these are, of course, named because they're from the air. They look like these.
And the hill shapes look like a galloping horse.
Right, yes. Right. So the 27th Infantry Regiment of the recently arrived 25th Infantry Division, Tropic Lightning, they receive orders to attack several hills that, and there's a ton of them. There's like a half a dozen or more. There's a bunch of little hills around there that make up the geographic feature nicknamed the Galloping Horse. The attack commenced with a tremendous artillery barrage by six battalions of artillery and coordinated airstrikes on suspected Japanese positions in and around the valley and between the hills that were the primary objectives of these soldiers. The Army gained some pretty significant gains in these attacks, don't they, Dave? The artillery softens up the positions pretty good, and the airstrikes do, and the Army does kind of push through that area pretty well, don't they?
Yeah, so these attacks was designed to isolate the Gifford, because like I said before, there was a small Japanese getting limited supply through the western side. So what Patch wanted to do, these series of ridges was to the west of the Gifford across Matanikau. And there was some Japanese up there. So if he thought if he could send the fresh 25th Division with their fresh regiments, they're going to isolate the Gifu. So the 132nd was pulled out around the Gifu, and the 35th Regiment, the regular army of the 25th Division, came in and took their place. So he had those guys isolated in the Gifu. Pinned in the Gifu. He didn't want to isolate the Japanese supply by sending this 27th Regiment to take those hills. Once the 27th have taken those hills, then the orders for the 35th, you're going to reduce the Gifford. You're going to destroy that pocket. But first, you had to isolate it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that was what led to those attacks. And you mentioned the January the 10th kickoff, the first time on target, division time on target, artillery attack of the war, potentially. That's when they had the 155s there. It was a massive amount of artillery. So they started out moving up those hills. So if you go to my video called the Charles Davis and the Thin Red Line, to me, that's the most perfectly preserved battlefield on Guadalcanal. It's very isolated and the hills are still there. It looks exactly the way they do. The number of hills, like you said, they kicked off two battalion attack. It was the 3rd Battalion and the 1st Battalion of the 27th. And these are regular, you know, old Army guys. The Thin Red Line book, with James Jones, James the author, Jones, yeah. And he was actually a corporal at that battle and was wounded. I think he was in the 2nd Battalion. So they pushed off. And it's a good, great study on how water will stop a unit in its tracks, because they only had one canteen of water. In those days, they only issued one canteen of water. And then these guys wouldn't get much resupply. They had a small jeep trail that went to Hill 55, and that was where their kickoff point was. So they moved off. They hit a few Japanese strong points, and they got bogged down. And they ran out of water. And this was their first attack. Any of these were regular Army troops. The rest of the guys had been National Guard. These are regular Army troops, old Army, so to speak, with kind of like the 1st Marine Division. They were, I think, a bit of higher quality because they were professional soldiers and had the old Army corps of NCOs and officers.
Right.
Anyway, they got stopped in its tracks. And then a new battalion came in and to renew their assault on the second day. And that's when you get Charles Davis, and I don't know if you want to talk about that.
I do. Charles Davis, his story is, you know, he's one of the few that isn't a machine gunner who receives the Medal of Honor for his actions here. He's 2nd Battalion Executive Officer. He's Captain Charles Davis. Near Hill 53 is where this occurs. The American attack had stalled because of Japanese resistance. The night before Davis performs the action that he's recognized for with the Medal of Honor, he's running messages back and forth, is he not? If I remember that correctly.
If you ever go to the movie, the new movie, the modern movie, Thin Red Line, so we're not going to talk about a Thin Red Line movie. John Cusack in the movie loosely plays Charles Davis.
Charles Davis, yeah.
In his action. Yeah. So Davis was the executive officer. He wanted to get into the fight, so to speak. And he kept telling battalion commander, I want in there, you know, put me in coach, basically. Yeah. Put it like a football game. And then he seen his opportunity to run up a message. He goes, oh, can I run a message to the company commander? Yeah, here you go, Davis, just go. He never came back. He ran a message up and he remained up there with the guys. So the day before, him, a lieutenant called Sims and a couple other guys had moved in because the Japanese, once again, like I said, the point crews, they had a reverse slope position. Mm-hmm. So they had the bunkers on the reverse slopes. So you couldn't engage them with direct fire from the other slopes. So there, you had to go over the top of the crest, and that's when you ran into the Japanese pillboxes. So the Japanese let them, the Americans get on top of the crest, and that's when they would open up on them. Mm-hmm. So the Americans couldn't provide direct fire support to suppress those bunkers. So they had one cluster of bunkers that was covering a small gap. So every time the army would move through the gap, they would hit them. So artillery fire couldn't reach them, machine gun fire couldn't reach them. So Davis and the other guys had crawled up to a ledge, and if you go there to this day, there's a big coral ledge on that ridge. So they peeked over the ledge to try to find his bunker complex. And that's when Sims was shot in the head with a machine gun and died. So that to this day, it's called Sims Ridge. So he died. Then Davis located bunkers and he started calling 81 millimeter mortar fire. And they were suppressed there and he would call in a bit. And then at nighttime, they pulled back. So he gave his briefing to the battalion commander. And at this stage, the division commander was only about 200 yards away. That was Joe Collins, or Lieutenant Joe Collins, who later gained fame as a corps commander in Europe, which was my grandfather's corps commander in Europe. That's why. And he always mentioned Joe Collins. But Joe Collins was a division commander. He was one of these guys that liked to be up front. And he was witnessing all this. And then Davis gave his briefing to his commander, and they said, this is what we'll do. So, Davis, what I want you to do the next day, I want you to move to the western side with four guys, crawl up to where you think the bunkers are, throw some hand grenades, try to distract them. So, in that stage, the battalion commander and the whole company, battalion commander is going to lead them, they would move up to the eastern edge on that ledge. Then when Davis had distracted them, he was going to start blowing a whistle. And that would be the cue for the whole company to up and over the ridge to assault those bunker complex. What Davis did when they got there, they started throwing the hand grenades. Japanese threw hand grenades back, didn't explode. Then, I guess in the heat of the moment, Davis and the other four guys just jumped up and they started assaulting those bunkers themselves, and Davis in the lead. And Davis got to the first bunker, started throwing hand grenades in. He had his M1 Garand. He had a stoppage, which failed the fire. Then he just transitioned to his 45 and he kept firing. And they actually took out those bunkers. And then when he got to the bunker, he started blowing a whistle. Then the rest of the whole company come up and over the ridge. And then they attacked up the ridge and end up taking the Japanese position. But this whole thing was witnessed by the division commander and a lot of the other battalion, because it was, if you look at my video, that top of that ridge is a very highest area, that area, highest point of the area. So he was silhouetted up there. So the whole division, well, it's not the whole division, but probably two whole battalions and division commander witnessed this whole medal. And he goes, this is amazing what that guy did. And he lived through the war, David.
Yeah, he was skylined up on the top of the ridge right there. Yeah, that's the kind of inspiring leadership that you want when your attack is stalled. That's the kind of guy you want going up there and you know, providing that kind of leadership.
A rainstorm actually helped those guys, because they were the battalion that relieved the first, but the third battalion that did the assaults, it petered out from the lack of water, but they were running out of water too. Mm-hmm. They couldn't get the water to them overnight. They didn't get any, they had one canteen of water, but a brief rainstorm, which happens all the time on Guadalcanal, came and is enough to quench their thirst, to re-energize them enough to finish that assault. So, man, it's quite amazing.
The good Lord provides, you know?
Yeah.
So over the next week after these actions occur, over the next week, the Army does eventually drive those people off, the Japanese. They drive them off, drive them out, kill what is left of those people out there. It's estimated around, 400 Japanese are killed in that general vicinity.
And the Seahorse. I don't know if we can discuss the Seahorse.
For sure, yeah, because I want to talk about Fournier and what's his name?
Paul.
Yeah, Paul. Yeah. So not to be outdone when it comes to machine gunner stories on Guadalcanal, there's two pretty damn important guys that are United States Army recipients of the medal here. And this isn't the Medal of Honor show, but I mean, these guys earned it and they need to be talked about, because I guarantee you people who are listening to this have no earthly clue that there were two United States Army soldiers, one of which was 47 years old, by the way, who was an infantryman, or a machine gunner rather, in an infantry unit that received the Medal of Honor for actions on Guadalcanal. We'll talk about that in a second.
So you're pointing out how young he was?
Well, compared to an 18-year-old, that's an old man right there.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, absolutely.
That is an old man. So the 35th Infantry Regiment is assigned to capture the area near the Galloping Horse, nicknamed, as you said, Dave, the Seahorse. That defending the area were the remnants of the 124th Japanese and our old friend Colonel Oka. Guy seems to be everywhere. May talk about somebody who was probably glad to get the hell away from Guadalcanal.
He got away.
So anyway, as the Americans are advancing, they are coming under almost immediate Japanese attack that threatened their flanks. This is where these two gentlemen come into play. William Fournier and Lewis Hall were both machine gunners in the 35th Infantry Regiment. Both of their medals are posthumous. Dave, can you tell us a little bit about their actions here?
Yeah, so their battalion, so two battalions of the 35th was left at around the Gifu area to keep those Japanese in. So their battalion was going to flank to the south and come up north and hit these two areas, I mean, Hill 44 and 43, which was named the Gifu, or sorry, the Seahorse. They were going to that was their objective. So they're moving up. As they're starting to move up into the first hill, they're crossing one of the small forks of the Matanikau, real deep, if you can picture a real deep ravine, jungle ravine. So they're advancing. The first rifle platoons had moved up. So Fournier and Hall was in a machine gun squad, so they're carrying a light machine gun, the M1919 light machine gun. So they're moving up, and the Japanese had did a counterattack down the basically river valley. It was a part of a headquarters element, and they seen the Japanese coming, and they had to spin around very quickly and try to stop these Japanese, because if not, the Japanese would hit the rifle company right in its rear. Right. And they were, as you can imagine, they're going single file, and it would have really stopped their attack and killed a lot of American soldiers. So they responded very quickly. One machine gun crew was killed. So Fournier and Hall, because the steepness of the river valley, they couldn't depress the machine gun enough by just laying it on the ground and firing. So one of the two, I forget which one, took the machine gun tripod, put it on his back, and leaned forward, and the other one took the machine gun, and they could traverse it that way by putting it on his back and him laying down enough to elevate it straight down. And then they're firing it like that. One's basically holding the tripod on his back, and they're just like a mobile machine gun mount. And they're firing. They're stopping the Japanese and holding the Japanese off enough for the rest of the Americans to start deploying their forces to engage those Japanese. Mm-hmm. But in the heat of this fight, both Fournier and Hall was killed in action, holding a position.
I think it was Hall who was 47 years old. Hall was the one, if I'm not mistaken, had the machine gun tripod on his back, because he's killed right there. Like he is killed right there. Fournier, he dies he's obviously severely wounded. He dies like a couple days later because of that. But I believe Fournier was the actual trigger puller and Hall was the mount, if you will. But I mean, that's amazing. That's serious. That's serious stuff right there. And
so
go ahead.
What I was going to say is, this is a remarkable conclusion to, you know, a long sequence of battles in Guadalcanal. And a while ago, I talked about, you know, jointness and joked that it didn't start with Goldwater Nichols, that it existed in Guadalcanal. But the one thing I might criticize about our jointness during World War II was our failure to share lessons across services. So the Marines started this campaign in Guadalcanal and learned a lot of lessons about jungle warfare. including some of the things like the ravines and depression of the barrel of machine guns and things like that. Did we do a good job, even an adequate job, of sharing those kinds of lessons across the service from the Marines to the Army before they landed? Because there was plenty of time to do that if somebody had been assigned to make sure they were trained for what they were going to face. Did we?
Yeah, we did, but in certain factors. I know some examples. We talk about Ken Bailey. He was wounded, and he was sent back to New Caledonia. So him and another Marine officer, this was in August, was talking probably to these same officers here and giving them lessons learned. After the Guadalcanal campaign, I know Puller and a number of other was sent on George Marshall, the chief of staff, sent Puller and a number of other officers on like a tour of the Army bases in 1943, lessons learned. They wrote a book.
That's incredible.
There's a book That's called Jungle Fighting or Lessons Learned on Guadalcanal. It's a whole book, and it's just basically excerpts of these guys telling lessons.
Mm-hmm.
I know Puller's in there. There's a number of guys. You know, Puller was talking about the Japanese Navy order. You know, we need that.
Yeah. But it wasn't soon enough to help the 25th ID and the other Army units that landed in October, November timeframe.
We discussed before, Guadalcanal was a major training ground, but they did learn lessons, and they built upon that for all their services. Yes.
Yeah. And I mean, I think the case could be made, Bill, you're 100% right, and that, you know, while the Corps were the ones learning the hard way, learning on the fly, you know, and if you go all the way back to our episode, we're entitled Operation Watchtower, I called Guadalcanal the classroom, because everybody learned, be it in the air, on the seas, in the jungle, where, what have you, how to fight a war against the Japanese. The Army's no different, but you know, when you've got that resource there that is the 1st Marine Division, people like Jesse Puller, you know, Vandergrift, Whaling, Edson, you know, all these people that have been in close contact, sometimes physically, with the enemy, in the case of Edson and you know, people like Bailey, you know, earlier, you know, you would think that some of the Army officers would have sucked this information up like a sponge. And to some, you know, they did. But you know, there's clear evidence that the Army was trying to do things their own way. And that's the way of the service, man. You know, the Army's they're not going to listen to the Marine Corps. What the hell do they know? Well, I don't know. They've only been here since friggin' August. But, you know, it is what it is. That's that inter-service rivalry.
You work for the Army. Remember that, Seth.
I do. Abundantly clear. I do. But it's the truth. I mean, if you look at the performance of the two forces or service branches here on this island specifically, you know, you can see that one didn't necessarily listen to the other too closely, or if they did, they were doodling in their notebooks. They weren't necessarily taking notes. And I mean, that's not necessarily to fault the Army, because they obviously performed heroically. I mean, in the case of Hall and Fournier and Davis and people and many, many others like them. Mm-hmm. The Army's performance on Guadalcanal is not what it will be later on in the war in the Pacific. I mean, if you look at the Army on New Guinea, they're doing good. They're doing good work there. Absolutely. And for the rest of the Solomon's campaign, they're doing excellent. I mean, God only knows the Philippines, you know, that's an Army show, but and other islands, Okinawa, you know, the Marianas, I mean, go on and on and on and on and on. Right. But this is where, you know, you would think some of those lessons that the Corps had learned the hard way would have been absorbed a little bit better, but they're not.
So once they isolated the Gifu, the 35th went in and reduced it. And that was a very, they finally brought in three Marine tanks. They borrowed three Marine tanks, and they had the division reconnaissance guys driving the tanks, the Stuart-like tanks. They brought three in, but only one made it up to the area. And that was enough to, you know, that was the turning point, because the Japanese didn't have any tank weapons. The Army didn't have any flamethrowers. Contrary to what people think, there was no flamethrowers. They wish they had flamethrowers. They had the old-fashioned way of hand grenades and rifles. And their mortars couldn't work. And even in the bunkers couldn't be taken out unless it got hit by 105 millimeter. So anyway, the one tank that got up there was enough to point blank take out these bunkers. So they reduced the Gifu from there. And then that allowed, once they reduced the Gifu, then Patch and the rest of the Army, and at this stage, January 4th, the 2nd Marine Division was formally formed. And a lot of people don't even know the 2nd Marine Division was even on Guadalcanal. You mentioned the 2nd Marine Division. They go, well, they wasn't on Guadalcanal. And yes, they were entirely. They were there. And it was quite funny when we're talking about inner service. The division assistant commander, a brigadier general of the 2nd Marine Division, was there. The major general was still left in New Zealand because he outranked in senior the Army General Patch on the island. So the Army thought if they bring the Marine General in, he would take command. And even the Marine General says, no, look, I'll default and you can still retain command. But this stage, there was a whole U.S. Army Corps there, the 14th Corps. They made the Corps. So anyway,
So that would have been commanded by a 3-star?
No, a 2-star.
Corps commander.
Okay. He was, because there was two major generals there, and they've brought the Army, the Marine Major General would have came in. He was had more time in grade, so to speak. And he said, well, you outrank Patch. They couldn't have that. They couldn't have the Marine out over the Army. So that's another example of inter service rivalry. So the 2nd Marine Division was there. He had the 25th Division. So they're going to resume their assault and finish up the Japanese and push them. So they assaulted past Matanikau on that Matanikau line we talked about. And they started pushing the Japanese back. And this is, I want to mention the CAM Division. Bill had mentioned it earlier. So they had a combined, the only time in the whole World War II, I think the only time in U.S. history, a combined Army-Marine Division. So you had two Army regiments and a Marine regiment all combined into the whole division.
The CAM Division. For about
two or three, the CAM Division, combined Army-Marine Division. So they fought on the coast, the 25th crawled on the left. They pushed the Japanese back. At this stage, the Japanese already decided by the high command we're going to evacuate Guadalcanal. But the Americans still thought that the Japanese were still going to fight for it. But they pushed, and they pushed them all the way back to Cape Esperance. But the Japanese had landed a fresh battalion just as a rear guard unit to cover that withdrawal. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like the Gallipoli campaign in World War One. You know, the most successful part of the Japanese campaign was their evacuation. Right. So in the early week of February 43, they evacuated anywhere between 10 to 13,000 Japanese. They weren't in great shape, but they ended up evacuating them over a series of nights.
Shocked that an Australian brings up the Gallipoli campaign. Just really surprises me. Australian-American. Yeah.
But you know, the evacuation of the Japanese off of Guadalcanal is miraculous in and of itself, considering the fact that they were able to get these people out of there, not always successfully, but for the vast, you know, the majority of their operation there was successful, yet they couldn't keep them supplied. So, you know, there's no, you know, conspiracy there. I'm just saying it's rather miraculous that they could get these people out of there without enormous losses. You know, and I think that goes to show, you know, while, yeah, Guadalcanal was swelling in terms of, you know, American presence there, the people that were there, and this goes back to my point of Guadalcanal just, you know, sucking the life out of everybody that was there. The forces by the end of this campaign, especially on the Japanese, but on the American side too, despite the addition of fresh forces, they were worn out, man.
Yes.
They were just worn out. Yeah. Everybody was tired. Everybody was done. Everybody was spent. And there's a reason that things kind of peter out after February 1943 until, you know, later on in that year.
And again, for the listeners, a lot of the Army units we talk about in this podcast no longer exist. They've been disestablished, or to use the Navy expression, decommissioned. The 25th ID, of course, still exists. Mm-hmm. My 11 years in Hawaii, I got to know them up in Schofield Barracks a little bit anyway. But the AmeriCalga Division lasted through Vietnam, but I think it went away while I was on the joint staff in the late early 90s, I think. Anyway, it's interesting that some of these units you may not have heard of unless you're a World War II aficionado. It's because they don't exist anymore.
A lot of our elements still, National Guard units still to this day, they have a lineage. But there was more. Right. Something that a lot of people don't realize, it was more U.S. Army than U.S. Marines on Guadalcanal. In the end, there was more U.S. Army.
In the end.
Not many more, but there was many more. We're talking about 2.5 divisions.
Yeah.
2.5 or plus more if you put auxiliary units.
Yeah. And that's
U.S. Army on Guadalcanal.
And that's hugely important. You know, when you think of Guadalcanal, your first thing you think of is the 1st Marine Division. And that's rightfully so, because when you said there were 2.5-ish, plus or minus a bit, Army divisions, you got to remember from August until the 164th arrived in October, there was one Marine Division on Guadalcanal. And even then, it wasn't a full division until September, until the 7th got there too. And I mean, that's, that makes, there's a reason that the 1st Marine Division divisional insignia has Guadalcanal written right down the middle of the number one, and with the Southern Cross. You know, it's because that is their highest honor right there, is that campaign for Guadalcanal, because they were the lone wolf, man. They were the only guys there for a long, long time.
Can I mention one quick thing from a veteran talking about it was like a veteran association meet after the war. Mm-hmm. He told about different stages of Guadalcanal and who was there. He was the 1st Marine Division vet, and he says it was at a reunion. All these Guadalcanal vets, and there's some Army guys there, Navy. But he said there was different stages. You had the first stage, first 2 or 3 months. You could tell who the guys there first 2 or 3 months, and then the second stage, the guys who were there from, you know, say from November to February. And then the guys who were there after there was no fighting, right. He said, we were there. He said, there was these 2 Army guys talking about the mules, because they did use some mules in the hills. Mules, mules. And this Marine goes to the other Marine. He goes, mules? Do you remember any mules on Guadalcanal? He goes, nah. If we had mules when I was there, we would have ate them. So he said that was the distinction. You could tell which stage, which vet was
The ones that were eating the mules, the ones who would have... You know, loaded the mules.
Loaded right? the mules. Yeah.
Yeah. He said if there were mules there, like the first at the very beginning, he said we would have ate them all.
And there's no doubt. I mean, I don't think that's an exaggeration. He probably wasn't trying to be funny. He was being serious.
Yes.
Yeah. There's a reason that the Japanese called it Starvation Island. Yeah. There's a reason that the Marines, you know, called it the island, and that's, you know, just the island. You know, and it had a mystique all of its own. It still has a mystique to its own.
Or the canal,
yeah.
And the local Solomon Islanders to this day, you know what their name for it is? The Big Death.
Yeah.
The Big Death, because that's all they know. There's a lot of people die. The big fella Death.
Yeah. Well, the Japanese also called it the Island of Death. I mean, it was, you know, it was just this.
It was a graveyard of the Japanese Army.
And the Navy, too. I mean, it was just this sump of human life, you know, it just...
What a quote Monty Python, the Japanese Navy would have said, I'm not dead yet.
Do you want to mention real quick the casualties or the figures?
Yeah, I do. I don't have those numbers in front of my face at the present time, but, you know, it's something we've made a point too, is that the United States Navy actually suffered more casualties, killed in action anyway, than did the Marine Corps.
But I also say that the misery index was much higher for the Marines.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's no denying that.
Higher death for the Navy, higher misery for the Marines.
Yeah. Yeah. No doubt.
So there was something like about 5,500 U.S. and Allied Australian sailors that died in the campaign. It was about 1,500 to 1,600 ground troops that died. Probably about 500 of those are U.S. Army, the rest were Marines. Japanese figures, who really knows, there was probably anywhere between 30,000 to 40,000 Japanese on the island that served on the island, anywhere between 25,000 to 30,000 died.
These are ground troops only.
Yeah, ground troops. And then there's probably about 9,000 or 10,000 of them died from disease and starvation.
Right.
So roughly 20,000 to 25,000, you could probably say the Japanese died, because they evacuated 10,000 to 13,000.
Dude, compared to 1,500 ground troops for the American side.
But the suffering, as we mentioned, there was 8,000 Marines in the 1st Marine Division, 8,000 suffering from malaria alone. I mean, you look at a division, say, for example, 15,000, 9,000 are in the rifle companies. They're your fighting troops. So if you say a division loses 3,000 men, you think, well, that's not many. They got 15,000. That's 3,000 frontline fighting troops. That's a major impact.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway,
we could go on forever.
It's basically, if you count illness as a casualty, 100% casualty rate.
Oh, yes, it was.
Oh, yeah. Probably more than that, frankly. Yeah. I mean, because you got guys that are going back up.
It doesn't get you a purple heart, but it counts for putting you down.
Well, you know, you say that. You don't actually get the medal of the Purple Heart, but I remember my buddies from 1st Marine Division who were on the canal, they said that they, while they weren't wounded, their Purple Heart was the malaria that they carried all the way into the 50s.
Yeah, I believe that.
So keep that in mind. Well, gentlemen, with that, I think we're going to wrap up this episode. We want to thank you all for listening in or watching our conversation. Please subscribe to the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast wherever you receive your podcast. Give us a rating and review. We do appreciate it. Check us out on YouTube. I know the great majority of you are, and we thank you very much for that, for putting up with my face every week. Bill's a handsome guy. Dave's a handsome guy. Really? And then you just got me. So anyway, look us up on Facebook and subscribe and like our page and all that jazz up there as well. If you are so inclined, send us an email at unauthorizedpacificpodcast@gmail.com. We do respond. It takes us a little while, but we do get to you, I promise. Every comment, every email is read. They're not all responded to, and there's no preference. It's sometimes things just slip through the cracks. So if you haven't gotten a response, I apologize. But with that being said, I want to thank you again for watching, listening. My name is Seth Paradin. Bill.
Yeah. And I want to thank everybody as well. As we record this in early January, 2023, we just passed 50,000 YouTube views and 15,000 audio downloads. So thank you all for watching and listening.
We're getting there. Dave, thanks again, man, for hanging around with us. And we'll be talking to you again.
No, I really love the opportunity, and I really enjoy talking to you guys.
Good, man. Thanks. Appreciate it. All right, guys. Until next week. Thanks.